Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, where every Monday morning you can hear views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-colonial perspective. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. Today on our show, Laurie Mercier speaks with PSU professor Bill Knight about the looming crisis in Oregon's higher education and at Portland State University in particular. Desiree Hellegers mulls over the connections between immigrant deportation, wars abroad, and the Epstein scandal. We'll give the last words this morning to homeless persons in Portland who are featured in a video by Welcome Home to tell their stories. It's our final show of the year, a year in which we've witnessed the rapid assassination of our already compromised democratic norms and vicious attacks on education, public health, science, the environment, and above all, on communities of people, our neighbors, family, and friends who happen to be the wrong color or were born in the wrong place or who express the wrong ideas. But we've also seen a massive uprise in resistance. And as the year comes to a close, we're having more success in the courts, at the ballot box, and on the streets. We are fighting back. And that's the theme for our winter membership drive. We hope to raise $75,000. Your donation now will help KBOO continue to fight back against oppression with information, networking, and support for all the diverse communities that make up the larger community of KBOO. Please support volunteer-run, listener-supported radio in Portland. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Now, before we get rolling, I want to share with you a little bit of music.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
was Killing Me Softly, a hit single from 1973 by Roberta Flack. Flack was a classically trained musician who broke barriers against black women with her socially conscious and unique blend of musical genres. Sadly, she passed away this year. During today's show, I'll be playing musical spots from other prominent singer-songwriters who died this year. It was a year of significant loss. Portland State University is a key driver of economic prosperity in Portland, but the continued existence of the school as it is now is currently under threat. Lori Mercier speaks with PSU professor and president of the PSU American Association of University Professors, Bill Knight, about the drastic budget cuts proposed by PSU administration. Knight argues that the depth of the cuts will have long-standing and devastating effects not only on PSU, but also on the economic recovery of Portland. He points out that the university could do much more to avoid these cuts.
Good morning. I am speaking with Bill Knight, Associate Professor of English at Portland State University and President of the PSU American Association of University Professors, or AAUP, which represents about 1,200 instructional faculty at the university. Welcome to KBOO, Bill.
Thanks, Laurie. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to be on the show.
Well, higher education is being assaulted from many directions, and colleges and universities across the nation are facing financial crises. But let's talk about the current situation at PSU. What has its administration proposed to cut costs, which threatens many critical programs and faculty jobs?
The administration has put forward a narrative that all we can do in the present moment is to significantly transform the university through cuts. So we're undergoing a big program evaluation process that involves the use of data that's been sort of put together by a consultant firm called Gray DI. And the university is using that in its own perspective on what needs to change and what ought to go. And it's going to propose a number of departmental and program changes and cuts, and we're going to see significant impacts here at PSU. And I suspect the total number of layoffs, according to the university's own narrative, looks to be around 220 FTE, which is to say full-time equivalences, so 220 people. So those are big changes, and it's going to change what we do, and it's going to change the impact PSU has on the city and the region. And we're really, really concerned about the lasting harm that those changes will have.
Now, both the Faculty Senate and AAUP have condemned this report from the administration, the Bridge to the Future 2.0, which explains these cuts. And the Faculty Senate referred to much of the data as dirty data. Do you want to say more about what's problematic about this report?
Well, the Faculty Senate voted in April this past year, no confidence in the plan, the Bridge to the Future plan. That was the first Bridge to the Future plan that was implemented last year. That resulted in 104 FTE cuts, which is to say the equivalent of 104 layoffs. But there were a lot of methods of producing that through efficiency and transforming what we do other than simply laying people off in that moment. It looks like the present moment, Bridge to the Future 2.0, is going to result primarily in layoffs. But the Faculty Senate was really concerned about the data, in part because there are lots of ways Gray's methodology is flawed. It doesn't serve all of the majors and programs that it analyzes that well when it comes to employment outcomes and the way in which it analyzes the results for students of those programs. It tracks interest in programs in part through things like Google searches, and that's a flawed and maybe a lagging indicator as a way of analyzing interest and demand in programs. There are other things that the Senate was concerned about that involved their notion of the dirty data. We just put through a request for information on a number of levels about the way Gray DI is being used in this case and how they're relying on it and more. We're hoping to intervene in all of that, and we're hoping to partner with the Faculty Senate to do so. So we're looking for, we're looking forward to working in January and beyond with the Faculty Senate to offer the best critique we can of the plan the administration is putting forward.
And much of what the administration is using to justify these cuts is its claim about plummeting enrollment. And I know that universities across the country have been suffering enrollment declines, partly due to COVID. And, it doesn't help that Trump and the right wing are claiming college degrees are useless, but there's also demographic changes. But how do faculty analyze those enrollment figures, and are they really declining for those reasons, or have administrators failed to boost enrollments in particular ways?
Looking at the situation, especially with regard to comparator metro areas, so metropolitan areas that have our population or roughly our population, we are way behind in terms of enrollment at the major public institution in our metro area. Most metro areas our size, Sacramento, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, San Antonio, Charlotte, others, they have 2 to 3 times the number of students enrolled at the major public institution in the metro region. So there's clearly unmet demand in that set of relationships and in our population. We have not adequately recruited, we have not adequately created the kinds of partnerships, transfer pathways, marketing, and other relations that entangle us and make us essential to Portland, the region's economy, and to the opportunities that students here want. There's so much more we could do. So it's absolutely a case in part of mismanagement. COVID had a huge impact on PSU. There's no doubt about that. But it's clear looking at comparators, looking at the way other universities, UNC Charlotte, for instance, somewhat comparable metro area. Charlotte has 2.8 million people. We have 2.5. Charlotte just enjoyed its highest enrollment ever this year, 32,000 students. The entire University of North Carolina system has more students enrolled this year than ever before. Why are we not finding ourselves that valuable to the people and the employers of Portland and the region? What's wrong here? I don't see any solution to those questions in the plan being offered by the administration. That's the really fundamental challenge, is there is no real reinvestment in recruiting, in changing our outcomes, in marketing, in connecting with employers. There's some lip service being paid to that, so to speak. There's talk of how those things will be worked on by President Cudd. But looking at the numbers, looking at the money, those are unfunded mandates. There's no money in the plan that really redirects us toward growth and toward a better impact on the city and the region.
Well, one thing that you mentioned in your AAUP response to these proposed cuts was how international student enrollment decline has represented a big part of the losses that PSU has experienced.
It is a significant part of this. And I think, we had an exchange in which you mentioned that that's a difficulty nationwide, and it is. And the Trump era is a really uncertain one for international students. These are incredibly political and challenging relations, and universities are struggling with this issue. But we started to dismantle our internationalism even before the Trump inauguration, the second Trump inauguration. And we backed away from our Nanjing Portland State Institute and closed our IELP, Intensive English Language Program. That was a significant shift. And then we backed away from a China program that was run by the Department of Engineering, or the School of Engineering, rather. And now I found out, through my work with International Student Services last spring, and this is something I brought to the Board of Trustees' attention, we completely backed away from recruiting at the international level. We have a skeletal team of recruiters. In fact, I think, we've reduced our number of recruiters, our full-time recruiters for international students, essentially to one or maybe one and a half people, from what I understood from my work with International Student Services last spring. And we've dropped our numbers of international students from 2,200 to around 750. That impact is significant on the finances of the university. All of those impacts that I mentioned are significant. So it's not that we have to choose between international students and Oregonians or supporting the local economy and opportunities for students here. Those things are additive. They can build and mutually support each other.
Now, thinking more broadly about this impact of the proposed cuts, what would this mean for Portland and the state of Oregon, since PSU is one of the three largest state universities and arguably serves those most in need of higher education in the metro area?
It's a huge impact. Unless we recognize the significance, we really have the outcome that we can help generate for the future of the city and the state. We're leaving so much on the table, and we're mortgaging our future, essentially. Portland State has a $1.8 billion impact on the economy annually. That's what the university's own website will tell you. Every dollar the state invests in Portland State produces something like a 12 plus dollar return on investment. It's an incredibly lucrative investment that the state can commit to. Politically, it's challenging because the state seems to be caught up in addressing so many short-term issues that it doesn't seem courageous enough to consider the long-term questions of particularly the economy in the future, past a time frame of 2 to 3 years. It doesn't seem as though they can recognize the significance that higher education plays in that scenario. But I asked our president Ann Cudd and our provost Shelly Chabon how many students we needed to recruit to fill the budget hole that would help us prevent all of these layoffs and all of these program changes and dismantling whole parts of the university. And they said 1,800 students is what we need to fill that hole. And, we could easily do that if we pause a moment and reinvest in recruitment and workforce connections and marketing and more. We can easily find our way to avoiding this unnecessary damage and harm to the university and its capacity to serve the city. If we don't recruit 1,800 students, we don't think about our duty as investing in that, and we lay off 200 people, that's a significant evacuation of folks from downtown Portland in itself. It backs away from a commitment to revitalizing downtown. If the city is concerned about the economic status of downtown business, the way real estate is occupied, and the way retail is working as well downtown, Portland State could be a real contributor to a return to a thriving downtown Portland. But laying off 200 people and then not recruiting 1,800 students, not committing to recruiting more that are there for us if we want them, all of that backs away from our responsibilities to Portland. And we're not being a good partner in that process.
It also seems designed to further lead to this death spiral. I mean, if 104 faculty were laid off last year and now there's another proposed 250, that's a huge percentage of faculty and capacity for expanding enrollment. And also, once you eliminate programs, you also reduce the attraction of programs in the university. So that just seems to represent a further decline of this critical university in our community.
I fully agree with you. That's concerning a lot of faculty and staff here. That's really, I think, our deepest concern is that there is no future being imagined in this plan. It only points to something like the death spiral you're telling us about. And it wasn't that 104 last year were laid off. The equivalent of 104 full-time positions was saved in the program of Bridge the Future 1.0. So they did that through reorganization, retirements, and through attrition. They did lay off 17 faculty members last year as part of all that, and they did so in a bad faith way that refused to respect the contract's requirements of shared governance. And we're still in arbitration, or actually, we're still waiting to implement the arbitration's ruling in which 10 of those faculty members were ordered to be reinstated at the university. And the university is presently refusing to respect the binding arbitration's ruling. But in regards to the death spiral, there is no clear sense of what happens to enrollment when you cut that kind of institutional capacity. How does the reputation of the institution falter? What happens when all of this publicity about this kind of straight ahead, we're not collaborating and listening to anyone, we're just going to cut program of leadership on the part of the president? Faculty are extremely unhappy about it, and the staff too are extremely unhappy about it. What happens to the university's reputation when that struggle persists for quite some time? The question for me is just how can we revitalize Portland State? How does any of this contribute to that prospect? It doesn't seem to me that it does.
This is your host, Patricia Kohlberg, with the Old Mole Variety Hour, interrupting this interview to remind you that we are in the final days of our final membership drive for the year. We'd love for you to donate to keep community radio alive in Portland. We'd love it even more if you signed up for a monthly donation. You can do that by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also give by texting KBOO to 44321 or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. Help us to reach our $75,000 goal. Now, back to Lori Mercier with Bill Knight.
Well, Bill, nationally, AAUP has for years charged universities with the failure to support the core missions of teaching and research as they expand administrative positions. Is administrative bloat an issue at PSU, and have those positions been included in these proposed cuts?
There's no clear sense to me in which there's a real thoroughgoing analysis of the structure of administration here. We certainly have a lot of money being paid out at the top. I would agree administrative bloat exists here. The Huron Report, which was a consultancy report produced by the university a few years ago, proposed that there was indeed a lot of bloat and inefficiency in administration and in management, and asked for various kinds of reorganization. I think they're working on some of that, but the administration really isn't looking at itself very clearly. And what it seems to do over and over again is hire more consulting firms and throw money at sort of technocratic analyses of things like the gray DI data that it's using to cut programs. And of course, also its legal fees as it fights reinstatement of our non-tenure track faculty that it laid off last year. It's throwing money at consultants over and over again in ways that are remarkable. When we hire a provost, as we're in the process of doing this year, we also hire a search firm, and that's a national search conducted by a private firm. There are lots of ways in which the administration likes to not only pay itself and to increase its ranks and its own power at our university, but to throw money at consulting.
You know, along with that litigation, which is another example of how the PSU administration is using scarce resources to actually fight faculty.
Yeah.
I'm curious if PSU, like other universities in the last few years, has tried to limit speech and academic freedom on campus. I understand that a faculty member expressing solidarity for Palestinians has been laid off, while another, you know, rabidly racist Zionist professor continues to teach. How has PSU reacted to this crisis of academic freedom on university campuses?
I think at the heart of it, there's a managerial self-interest that governs those issues here on campus. When it's convenient for management to support free speech issues, it does. But when it's really inconvenient for speech to be free or for people to say certain things, management will clamp down and propose that we cannot say those things, that we have to back away from that, and we have to change our rules. This year, we're in the administration's in the process of proposing an institutional speech policy. We don't have a draft of that yet, but there is a committee being formed, and this will be a process that ultimately winds up in the Faculty Senate, I think, and I would hope. This comes from the president. The president wants to change how we, our rules basically about what can be said by members of our academic community here. And I think those are extremely dangerous changes. So we're going to be an active partner in that conversation. The AUP is going to preserve the rights and demands of academic freedom. There are a number of moments in which the university has fallen afoul of our expectations, and there are investigations ongoing right now. At least one significant investigation involving a faculty member's expressions. So we are fighting these fights, demanding the university commit itself to the academic freedom principles that it already says it's committed to. And we'll continue to do that.
Great. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Bill Knight, PSU Professor of English and President of the AAUP Faculty Union, about PSU's proposed dramatic cuts to academic programs and faculty positions. Bill, I think we should also address the long history of the lack of state funding for higher ed. I think Oregon ranks 46th or somewhere near the bottom in the nation, which may explain why Charlotte and North Carolina are doing so much better. I suspect their state funding of their universities is better than Oregon's. So what's behind that lack of support, And how can the state prevent further decline of public university programs and resources?
So you're absolutely right. In terms of public university funding, we are 46th in the nation. The governor has commanded HEC, which is the governing body of our public university system, to propose either 2.5 or 5% cuts to its general funding framework. And if either of those models goes through this year, we'll essentially fall to the bottom of the nation in public university funding, which is astonishing. I'm not sure exactly how long we've had a supermajority in the legislature here, but the Democrats have been in control for quite a long time. But in effect, we seem to be governing the state in terms of our commitment to education, as though we wanted a Republican victory or that we were doing the work of the Republicans, dismantling support for higher education, for public institutions, and for the way education leads to the future for the state that goes beyond mere economic impact, but to an enlightened citizenry, to opportunities and access for people of all kinds, for lots of opportunities for those who are first generation college students and more. It's astonishing to me that we are in the condition we're in, given that we've had the potential to make these changes and to commit ourselves to higher ed in a way that will be thoughtful and produce extremely positive results. So this is a higher ed emergency. We're essentially about to fall to the bottom of the nation in support for public university funding and for higher education. PSU is about to cut 200 plus people and dismantle entire programs. We could see whole departments closed. We probably will see whole departments closed in that process. The entire general education program called University Studies is being reevaluated and could be closed or changed fundamentally as well. And we could choose to intervene politically. Governor Kotek and the Democrats in the legislature could choose to intervene and recognize that this really is a higher education emergency. And Portland State is in a situation that is an emergency. We know that there's $1.2 billion in the Education Stability Fund that could be used if Governor Kotek declared an emergency. And it would be courageous, but also so necessary for her and the legislature to recognize the situation for what it is and intervene. And this would be part of their legacy. They need to intervene in a way that sets Oregon on the right path.
Is PSU AAUP collaborating with other state faculty unions to lobby the legislature and Kotek to really beef up support for higher ed?
Absolutely. We're doing everything we can on all fronts right now. We're part of a higher ed labor coalition. We met in Monmouth a few months ago to inaugurate our work, and we're meeting regularly to organize our lobbying impact, to focus on other issues like countering Trump's compact for higher education that have come up. And so we're in constant communication with the leaders of other state labor unions in higher education. I would like to be working with the university itself on lobbying Salem about all these things. The university has, it says it's lobbying for support for higher education, for all sorts of ways in which we could expand our programs that offer access. We're doing the same work. I would like to be doing that work with them as well. And what I've been doing, I think, is a much more emphatic version of that work, demanding that we recognize this as an emergency and making the case strongly for economic commitment and thinking particularly about the future, return on investment, how we offer opportunities for Oregonians. Those arguments are incredibly difficult to refute. This is a situation in which we're doing ourselves an incredible disservice. So right now, I'm involved with sort of a lobbying blitz. We're working with the Higher Ed Labor Coalition, but on my part, I'm engaged with conversations with city council, the mayor, with state legislators, with the governor, and with anyone else we can imagine in, engaging and asking for support in this situation. I'm going to be reaching out to business leaders as well. The university ought to have done that work, but it's, I think, given the dismal plan that they put together, it doesn't seem as though they have. And so I'm going to try to do the work to fill in for what the university seems to be backing away from.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Bill, and for raising attention to this really critical matter facing us in Portland and the region and the state at PSU with these threatened layoffs. Finally, how can listeners find out more about the impact of the proposed cuts at PSU and support faculty?
I would love listeners to reach out to their legislators, to the governor, and to indicate that they support higher education, that this is a vital need for Oregonians. At every level of government, this message needs to come now as a significant push. I think the city council even can have an impact on this situation by expressing its concerns about the effect on Portland that all of these transformations will have. I would love to be in contact with anyone who wants to reach out to me through the PSUAUP site, and I would absolutely offer avenues of engagement and support there. We just want folks to reach out to all of those in power right now and push the message that Portland State is a vital part of Portland, and to further back away from supporting this institution and to cut and cut and cut is going to lead nowhere for the city. We want the city to thrive, and I want to see a flourishing Portland State as well.
Well, thanks again, Bill Knight, for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
It's been fantastic. Thank you so much for the conversation and the opportunity.
That was Lori Mercier speaking with PSU professor Bill Knight about the uncertain future of Portland's flagship university. Sly Stone fused the sounds of funk, soul, and rock into an irresistibly upbeat sound that profoundly influenced the artists of the time and those who came after. Stone was another great musician we lost this year. Here's a clip from Everyday People by Sly and the Family Stone, their hit single from 1968. That was Sly and the Family Stone. KBOO is losing more than $100,000 because of federal cutbacks this year to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But we know our listeners have our back. There are those who would like nothing better than to watch KBOO shrivel up and die, but with your help, we're fighting back. Please give to KBOO if you can. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give. By texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. Next up, Desiree Helligers offers a far-ranging holiday reflection on the connections between colonialism, pedophilia, and the campaign of terror against immigrants. This is part two of her essay, which was published last week in Counterpunch. Part one aired last week on The Old Mole. A link to the full commentary will be posted on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. Here's Desiree.
Those of us who typically kick off the holiday with a seasonal viewing of Terry Gilliam's Monty Python-esque, comically star-stuffed dystopian 1985 film Brazil are likely to find the film, and the opening scene in particular, hits close to home this year. In a bleak, low-tech, retro future when everything's perpetually on the blink, it's Christmas Eve and a family is gathered round watching A Christmas Carol. No sooner has Tiny Tim uttered his annual benediction, "God bless us, everyone," when militarized jackbooted government thugs drill their way through the ceiling, and before the eyes of his traumatized wife and children, hood and drag away poor Archibald Buttle, rather than the freelance heating engineer and suspected terrorist Archibald Tuttle, played by none other than Robert De Niro. I was reminded of that scene this summer when masked agents wrenched Columbia University's graduate student Mahmoud Khalil from the side of his heavily pregnant wife, Noor Abdullah. begging the question of whether the kidnapping wasn't also calculated to induce a miscarriage. Needless to say, the Party of the Right to Life and Family Values should have been holding high-level meetings and getting to the bottom of it all. But as the old saying goes, the moral majority is neither. At least in the film, they gave Mrs. Buttle a receipt for her husband. As some of us celebrate the story of a family of Jewish Palestinian refugees fleeing to protect their child from a tyrant, the fact that Noor Abdullah carried the baby to full term seems downright miraculous. And the same seems true of women who go on giving birth and giving love amid the genocides in Gaza and Darfur, on the streets, in shackles, and in war zones and detention camps around the world. The new nanny state. I thought of that scene from Brazil back in September, seeing videos of an ICE assault on a Chicago apartment building in a historically Black neighborhood. A swarm of Black Hawk helicopters circled the building before agents rappelled down, kicking in doors, throwing flashbangs, tearing parents from children who were zip-tied together, held in dark vans or left out in the cold for hours in their underwear. As neighbor and witness Ebony Watson described it, the kids was crying, people was screaming, I was out there crying, where's the morality? Watson said she kept asking herself during the raid, where's the morality? I'm guessing Ebony Watson wasn't all that reassured when a Department of Homeland Security spokesperson later somberly intoned, for their own safety and to ensure these children were not being trafficked, abused, or otherwise exploited, these children were taken into custody until they could be put in the care of a safe guardian or the state. As if DHS was suddenly the voice of reason, a veritable Mary Poppins, Nanny McPhee, or Mrs. Doubtfire, schooled in the needs of children and ready to adjudicate safe and appropriate placements for them. Never mind that DHS Director Kristi Noem famously demonstrated her qualifications for higher political office under Herr Trump by recounting the ease with which she gunned down the family dog Cricket in a gravel pit for the capital crime of misbehaving during a pheasant hunt. The idea of immigration detention creating safe spaces for children who've been deliberately separated from their families seems like delusional, self-serving pedophile logic in the best of times, but more so under a president who keeps popping up in the Epstein photo dumps like a veritable elf on the shelf, while apologists like Megyn Kelly parse the distinctions between degrees of child rape in ways that John Oliver aptly dubbed pedophile math. And by the way, if you're bracing this holiday to face off over turkey with your racist, transphobic, Fox News-loving funny uncle, count your lucky stars you weren't born a Trump, because all the gold in the world can't gild that spite-filled lily or mask the not-so-quiet desperation those folks must be suffering as they deck the halls with cyber Santas and stuff down their holiday foie gras. And you can bet that anyone with a modicum of sobriety at the White House Christmas party knows enough to keep their kids from straying anywhere near Santa's lap. Trump, Epstein, colonialism, and thingification. Trump's repeated and obvious eroticizing of children, from his daughter Ivanka to teen beauty contestants, and his description of Virginia Giuffre being stolen from Mar-a-Lago by Jeffrey Epstein, seems proof enough that Martinican statesman and writer Aimé Césaire wasn't blowing smoke when he coined the term thingification in his essay Discourse on Colonialism. Quote, wherever there are colonizers and colonized face to face, I see force, brutality, cruelty, sadism, and conflict, observed Césaire, enumerating qualities that the orange Krampus and his assorted hangers-on openly celebrate in themselves and each other. And is it any surprise that they would find clergy willing to conjure and celebrate a god with exactly those qualities? Never mind the whole if you have not love bit. If Jesus came back today, Trump's Justice Department would be only too happy to dispatch him in a hail of bullets, the way they did Cop City protester Tortuguita, or haul his long-haired anti-fascist Jewish ass in front of Congress before shipping him off to ADX Florence, the Alcatraz of the Rockies. The imperial boomerang, the colonial fallout that we're up against that renders children's bodies sexualized disposable commodities, didn't begin with Trump or Epstein, but with Christopher Columbus. But for the past five decades, Republican and Democratic administrations alike, have siphoned off money for housing, healthcare, and education to fatten Wendigo war profiteers, the military-industrial beast Dwight D. Eisenhower warned of in his 1961 farewell to the presidency. Money for public housing and the war on drugs siphoned off to pay for the American war on Vietnam, for the war on drugs and war on terror, for a world made red in tooth and claw to profit the rich. The migration criminalized in the global north is the product of endless colonial violence, thingification, the exploitation of labor, land, and bodies. Climate change knows no borders, and today's high-tech, carbon-intensive, endless wars and the consumption that help fuel them are in danger, kids, of burning down Santa's workshop. And let's just say that the melting of the permafrost doesn't bode well for the future of his reindeer either. So we need to defund the colonial war machine like our future and our children's future depend on it. And the good news is that boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the U.S. and Israeli war machines are well underway, thanks to organizations like the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, Jewish Voice for Peace, and tools like the Boycott app that make it easier than ever to identify complicit corporations. We can take heart this year knowing that from Jenin to Eugene, Ramallah to Rome, New York to Chicago and LA, people of goodwill are organizing, striking, divesting, and pushing back, putting their jobs, lives, and bodies on the line for people they love and people they've never met, all of them bent on stopping fascism, genocide, and climate collapse in their tracks. All of us riding together on the same fragile, mother-loving dust speck. We can take comfort in knowing that in the new year, friends and family, total strangers from the tallest to the smallest, will be standing side by side in the streets, in their loafers and their cleats, with their bullhorns and their trombones and their whistles all blowing tweet, tweet, tweet. Oh, the people and the inflatables you'll meet. And we can take comfort in knowing in the new year that all that noise, noise, noise is the sound of the old world dying and a new one struggling to be born. Peace out. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Again, that was Desiree Helligers, who in this holiday season sees a new and more just world struggling to be born through the solidarity and hard work of activists the world over. Brian Wilson was another singer and songwriter of uncommon talent who passed away this year. He co-founded the Beach Boys, whose songs celebrated Southern California beach culture. Wilson's later work forged new dimensions in the genre of pop music. Here's an early Beach Boys song, Good Vibrations.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. Gentle on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations.
Good vibrations. She's by my excitations, but not good. Good vibrations, but not good. Excitations, but not good. Good vibrations, but not good. Excitations.
somewhere, but she sends me there.
That was Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. For our final segment this morning, we will hear from people living on the streets about how they got there and the barriers they face in getting off the streets. Fran Michelle opens the segment by telling us about the video project from which this audio comes.
Earlier this year, as we've discussed on a previous episode of The Old Mole, the Welcome Home Coalition, in partnership with Sisters of the Road, released their report, Finding Home, Lasting Solutions Rooted in Community Expertise, which surveyed and consulted those with lived experience of homelessness in the Portland area. That research confirmed that the city needs to pivot to a housing and support service-focused response to homelessness and away from the current system of sweeps and shelters. As part of the Finding Home project, Welcome Home produced a short film directed by Alex Wakefield, featuring the voices of people who know the solutions that will actually reduce homelessness. Welcome Home has graciously granted us permission to share audio from that film here on The Old Mole, but we also recommend watching it, since the visuals include informative text and compelling images. Here are the voices of some who truly understand the problems of homelessness and how best to address it.
The fear of being homeless has never left me or my sons. Though it's been 28 years since we got rehoused, I am now 61 years old. All the services that were in place all those years ago are gone. The streets are so unsafe for women. I see older women living on the streets and my heart breaks. Out of control rents. Lack of people caring has resulted in people in their golden years in a desperate survival mode.
I became houseless due to circumstances that I couldn't help. My husband had left. I lost the house. I lost the business. I lost everything and literally wound up walking away.
Kicked out of my house around 14. I never experienced having a place of my own. I was always couch surfing. And it has shelters.
When I first got to Portland, I had took a chance and did the whole Craigslist thing. My gut said no, but I did it anyways. And then when I came up here, they said they didn't know who I was, already taken my money, all that kind of stuff. So
I became a victim of domestic violence. My wrist was broken. I lost my career, my house, the boat, the car, the dream.
That age of growing up and trying to figure out what's going on with me and what kind of things I need to do to care for myself, how I fit in the world, what the world even is. And I ended up on the streets of Portland as a teenager.
So they towed my truck and they towed my RV in one fell swoop. Left me with a backpack and a couple of tool bags. I went from being a halfway normal person to nothing.
You're always one paycheck away. You could go to work tomorrow and next day lose your job and you're out there on the streets.
Yeah, I guess just like anyone, just life happens and it wasn't something I was prepared for, but I was thrusted into it and just trying to make the best out of it at this, you know, current time.
I didn't choose, you know, in third grade, when the teacher said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I didn't say I want to be homeless.
Why do we have, you know, a Congress full of men, full of white men, making decisions about women? Why do we have a Congress full of straight white men making decisions about the LGBTQ community? We only get authentic results when you are dealing with authentic people who are going through the real and raw experiences.
We're living in it. We know what it's like, and it's not like through pie charts or through different graphs or anything. It's actually lived experience, which I mean, I think there's no experience like lived experience.
It's not somebody sitting in a glass window saying that this is what it's supposed to be like.
I'm a number to a lot of those people. They don't know me. They don't know my story. They don't care about my story. I'm a number. That's all I am. I'm a figure to them.
These are the people who have lived through it, they have been saying what we need to do for a long time, and we just like need to listen to those voices.
It's so hard to get in, but it's so easy to get kicked out and thrown out, you know, and a lot of people don't get that second chance or opportunity because they blew it here. And if you blow it here, it's like you blow it statewide.
I have an arson on my record. I didn't burn nothing down. I threw a lighter at somebody and I took a plea bargain in California 20 years ago, and they're still holding it against me today. I never burned anything down.
Most of these shelters that they have around here, they don't open until 8 o'clock at night, and then you gotta stand in line and wait for your name to be called, and sometimes your name ain't even called, and then you gotta worry about where you're gonna sleep on the streets tonight. They need to have more opportunities.
Housing is notorious for just kicking the problem down the road.
And who wants to go live next to somebody in a congregate shelter when someone might have like schizophrenia or, you know, like they might be on a drug-induced psychosis? We don't feel safe.
It's not a system for the unhoused to be successful.
Ridiculous how people are marginalized and put into a certain box rather than being helped where they're at, regardless of circumstances. I think it's really important to provide housing first and then go back and triage and say, okay, how can we help you?
Banging our heads on old solutions that work that nobody's ever going to bother to follow up on, and old solutions that don't work that nobody cares about and keeps doing anyways.
Why don't they listen to the people who actually have to live it?
You know, we're not all derelicts, we're not all drug addicts, we didn't choose this. We just want to be heard, for one, and to have a fair chance in life.
I just got my apartment on Friday from Colter Bay.
I went through this outpatient program, and it introduced me to two housing programs. One's called Home Forward and one's called Urban League. I'm with both of them.
46 years old, and this is my first apartment ever.
Where I'm at now was because one of the other people in the shelter actually had found out that it was brand new and that they were actually taking applications for it.
I have a year rent free and they pay for it. I don't know how that works. I haven't gotten that far into it, but I'm going to find out. So they pay my rent for a year.
That's how we all kind of found housing, was that we were bouncing off of each other, saying this and no, I've already tried that, you do this, that kind of thing.
The ones that we do get into housing, it's always nice to see them getting in and like helping and being a part of things. I know what it's like because I was in their position, you know, so I get to really identify, like, being housed in a tiny home is one thing, but moving to an apartment's another thing, and then keeping that apartment.
Never give up on life. Never. If it gets you down in the dumps, look upstairs. Always remember where you come from. You know what I mean? Do not let life get you down.
People that are homeless are still people. Shouldn't be ignored. Shouldn't be considered invisible. Don't count. I wish people would actually take more time and talk to people that are homeless and find out the situation, because everyone is different.
And people talk about homeless people like they're the bad people. You know, some people are, some people aren't. Not everybody is the same as everybody else.
Just come talk to us. We just don't want to be exiled and treated like we're trash.
That was an audio clip from the video produced by Welcome Home. And that's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Lori Mercier, Desiree Helligers, and Fran Michelle for their contributions. And a special thanks to our guest, Bill Knight. Thanks, too, to the KABU staff who keep everything going behind the scenes. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host. One reason KBOO is so threatening to the white supremacist of the MAGA world is because we lift up a diversity of voices. So many communities have found a home at KBOO to share their happenings, their culture, their music, and their views. If you think that's important, please support community radio in Portland. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. The Moles want to wish you and yours all the best in the year to come. Stay safe, stay well, and above all, stay active. There is a lot at stake. I'm going to leave you today with one last song from the great reggae pioneer from Jamaica, Jimmy Cliff, who died just last month. Cliff is credited with introducing Jamaican music and culture to a worldwide audience. This is his hit song from 1970. You can get it if you really want. Thanks for listening.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last. Persecution